You're listening to Pod 4 Ham, a podcast that's all about the musical Hamilton, taking it one track at a time. Every episode features different groups of interesting people talking about a single track from the original Broadway cast recording of Hamilton. Visit us online at pod4ham, that's the numeral 4, .com. Follow us on Twitter at pod4ham, or you can visit The Incomparable at theincomparable.com.
This, Mr. Burr, get a medic for the general.
Yes, sir.
Lee, you will never agree with me, but believe me, these young men don't speak for me. Thank you for your service.
That's right.
Hamilton, sir, meet me inside.
Meet him inside. Meet him inside. Meet
Welcome back to Pod for Ham. I'm Jason Snell.
I'm Brian Hamilton, no relation.
I'm Elsa Shinnison Henry.
I'm Kathleen Showalter.
Well, here we are to talk about one of the most interesting little bits of Hamilton in some ways, because it's got no melody. It's 90 seconds long, and it's just a whole lot of talking. But, you know, that's okay. We can do that. Meet me inside. This is the bridge between the duel at the that's in Ten Duel Commandments. And then we move on to That Would Be Enough, which is he's sent away by Washington, sent home. But in between, we get the cleaning up of the battlefield of the duel, and then Hamilton gets a talking to from George Washington.
If this wasn't a opera, this would be a little segment that would be cut out of like the script. This wouldn't have been recorded to the cast album if it wasn't an opera where this was an actual rap.
I heard gasps.
I would think that if you cut this out, you'd have a problem, since it's an extremely pivotal 90 seconds for the entire show. So you would have an extreme problem there. But the the fact that it is sung through does mean that you get these little transitional bits where you might not elsewhere. But I was counting, because it's 90 seconds long. There's approximately 36 lines in there.
Yeah.
And of those 36, a third of them either reference a line or a lyric that's happened before, or one that is going to happen again. So it's pretty intensely packed for that short segment.
I like to think of this particular track as a coda in some ways, because it's linking everything up. And it's also a very transitional space in the way that can be within a song. It's sort of, we're making a transition between this stanza and that stanza, but we need to actually make that transition happen. Here, let's throw everything together and make it work.
Yeah, I think Brian's point, and the way I read it was, if the rule here wasn't everything's a song, this probably wouldn't be a song. It would be dialogue, because it is dialogue, although it's in meter with rhymes, but no melody to speak of. And it's also funny, in less than 90 seconds, it's sort of two movements, right? Or you could even argue it's three, right? It's the cleanup of the battlefield, the arrival of Washington, and then meet me inside, the actual Washington-Hamilton conversation. And it does spin the whole story off in a different direction.
Absolutely. And I think you could even break that third movement you mentioned, Jason, into two, because you have Washington chewing out Hamilton, and Hamilton doesn't move, and Washington is circling him and gesturing at him. And it isn't until right at kind of almost more than halfway through that segment that then Hamilton comes alive and says, give me a command, and comes back at him.
You're right. I mean, this doesn't have a melody per se, but it does have fascinating orchestrations to go along with the way that third act, Jason, plays out. There are violins in the background. I didn't notice that until I listened to it really, really closely in preparation for this. There are horrific violins in the background.
And the electronic thump at Call Me Son One More Time, that is the most, it's like this dramatic electronic hum that happens in the silence when you're like, oh boy, what's going to happen now, right? It's such
like
a great
a siren.
Moment. Yeah.
It does sound like a siren. It exactly sounds, that's what I thought, a siren there. And I wasn't even sure what that noise even was, like what was making it at first.
The line, "Call me son one more time," is the one that always smacks me in the face. The way that he sounds when he delivers it is in some ways the most emotional that we see him, because it's the most almost unrestrained.
Well, you know, we think about, I'm curious what you all think about this. You know, in the story, he's an orphan. He's not really an orphan, but his father abandons him and his mother. So we will go with calling him an orphan. But regardless, he's been on his own for a long time. And, you know, one way you can view that is with pity, that this poor kid had to do all of this because he wasn't given more support because of what happened in his childhood. But in this song, especially when he tells Washington twice not to call him son, there is this defiance to Hamilton that's like he is proud and independent, and, you know, almost like it's rubbing him the wrong way. He has this close association with Washington as a mentor figure, and he's like trying to push back of like, I'm independent. I don't need a father. Do not call me son again.
Absolutely.
Yes.
If you don't mind, I lost my father when I was a child, and that particular moment hits me hard because I recognize exactly what you're saying, Jason. I've had people say things like, "Well, you're like a daughter to me," and I'm like, no, you're a close friend. But this is actually a distinction that I've heard a lot of people who've lost parents say, is no, there's a difference between losing a parent and having somebody who's a familial figure. And I see Hamilton's outburst as that delineation, and I identify with it a lot. It's a really great moment.
That's incredible. No, you're right. The way he uses son is so condescending to Hamilton in a way that, no, that's the only way I can frame our relationship. And hell no, Hamilton's going to say, call me son one more time. You're not my father. He's a bastard orphan.
Yes, and there's a definite relationship between those two figures there, of the bratty adolescent almost, who's trying so hard to break free. Two people who see their relationship very differently from each other. Like, and there's a historical fact. I mean, Hamilton wrote this letter, and I'm sure you guys have seen this, that when he leaves Washington's command saying, you know, I never really liked that guy, we weren't friends, that relationship has some bearing in reality. But it's the sort of, you have to push back against the big famous guy who makes you in order to stand on your own, to make yourself on some level.
He wants to be his own man here. But also, let's not forget, this is also an overreaction on Hamilton's part, because Hamilton's in trouble. Meet me inside. He has been called to the principal's office, right? He is in trouble because he set up this duel. Washington gave him a direct order saying, look, we're just going to forget about Charles Lee. He can say what he wants. We'll let history be the judge. History will prove us right, right? And Hamilton instead schemes with Lorenz to do the duel, and they get caught. And so you know, part of this, I think, is like Hamilton's overreacting because he is pushing back on the fact that he's in trouble. Like he blew it with Washington. And so sometimes I see that overreaction that way, that he's just like he's just overreacting because he got caught. He's in trouble.
Yeah, that's that bratty adolescence element. You know, he's being defensive. he's standing up, and the whole posture that he has, where he is standing there kind of almost smirking, and he doesn't move, and Washington is gesturing, and Hamilton just stands there kind of taking it like every kid in every movie you've ever seen.
The other thing is that in the back of Washington's pocket is the fact that Eliza is pregnant, and Hamilton doesn't know that at this point. Yeah. So for Washington, it's much more complicated, in that your wife needs you alive, I need you alive, we can't have you running a battalion, etc. And for Hamilton, it's wah, 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 give me a battalion. I mean, to you know, paraphrase, but it's still a single-sided issue for Hamilton, which makes it much easier for him to be the bratty kid in this situation.
Well, and up until this point, Hamilton also has seen the only way for him to, as he says, rise up is with a battalion. And so when he says, you know, I don't have a name to lose, being told that, you know, sticking up for himself in this way is inappropriate, I think is kind of like, well, this is the only way I know how.
Yeah, I read that... having seen people, I managed enough people over 15 years to see this, of somebody becomes kind of obsessed with the thing that is their measure of success, and they keep asking for it, even if they don't like understand the steps to get there, and you tell them the steps to get there, they're not interested in the steps, they just are interested in the destination. And I see that when, you know, and in Chernow's book, it talks about it too, that Hamilton becomes kind of obsessed about being in the war because it will allow him to fight, and he'll either die and be a hero, or he will have established himself so that he can survive after the war. But I totally see Washington's point here too, which is, look, I get it, but this is not what I need from you. So I see both sides here, but you do get the sense at this point, like, Washington's heard this like too many times now.
Yes.
You say this every morning.
That's right. Here's the reports. Can I have a command? Yes, sir. All right. Here's some more reports. I'll be right back, sir.
Good night, Hamilton. Nice work. Most likely kill you in the morning.
The other thing I wanted to mention is I really like Washington at the beginning of this, after, you know, we get the Here Comes the General. Washington is he's the grown up. Like, mm-hmm. Not only did he tell them not to do this, but when Washington arrives, what does he do first? He tells Burr to get a medic, and he apologizes to Lee. He apologizes to this man who has said all these terrible things about him, because even though he'll never agree with him, and he says that, it's like, they don't speak for me, I thank you for your service. It is so grown up to do that, and you can feel his embarrassment, that his guys have embarrassed him by doing this.
And he shows such respect. You know, he's taking off his hat, he's bowing. There's always this sense of Washington as the compromiser, the person who, no matter how much he is going to disagree with the principal or get emotional, he maintains this leash on his temper and his rashness, that Hamilton really, that's his fatal flaw, that he can't do that. And Washington provides a real contrast there.
You see Washington, you know, and it's not necessarily the Washington is without flaw, but Washington,
no.
You see why Washington is better at this than Hamilton.
But you also see a less dynamic character in some ways in Washington, because you see the Icarus element of Hamilton. You see why he's so exciting and so charismatic and so dynamic. And you don't have quite as much of that in this Washington. He's the grown-up. He's not as exciting.
Yeah,
that makes sense. But at the same time, this is a musical about Alexander Hamilton. And
exactly.
That's in the weird middle point between like a musical about a nobody and a musical about, say, George Washington. And the fact that George Washington is an ancillary character in someone else's story is going to inform his character in the way he portrays it, because he is a little bit more flat, because a musical is not about him.
Exactly. And he exists, and in some ways, all of the characters exist to put the stark contrast to Hamilton's character, because they exist to shape Hamilton's character, not necessarily 100% as round characters in themselves.
Except maybe Burr, but that's another podcast.
Except maybe Burr, but that's another podcast, exactly. And
I do really appreciate his moment at the beginning of this song, "Well, this should be fun."
Mm.
We've already started to see some of the dynamic of push and pull with Hamilton and Burr. Maybe I get to watch you kind of trip up a little bit here.
Yeah, the staging, I think, really makes that very dramatic, because when you're watching the Ten Commandments, everything Hamilton and Burr do is in parallel. And you have bright lights and you have flashing and the stage is turning and it's like a target. And then all of a sudden, bam, it goes dark, and you have Washington come into the center, and then you start to lose some of that parallelism, and then you have Burr getting the medic and Burr reacting, and then Burr backing off stage, and Washington and Hamilton are just in the dark under a spot in the corner. So you have more of these contrasts that are being set up.
Yeah, it's also, I know it hangs over the whole production, but in this song, you really do see very clearly the things that drive Hamilton to his end.
That
this is the aftermath of a duel that will happen again, and it won't be as clear and as pleasant as this. I guess it'll be clearer in the sense that he's not going to make it out of that one. But you see that, and then in the second half, you see his pride and anger and worried about how other people feel about him, and all of that stuff is the stuff that drives him to behave the way he does, and honestly, for Burr to behave the way he does, that leads to their end. So I feel like that's the dark cloud that hangs over this entire thing. Is like, oh geez, they're not learning any lessons here. This is going to happen again.
Mm-hmm. Two more times, in fact. This is great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The music and the lyrics and reflect that very distinctly, because you have the counting that happens again with the second duel. Mm-hmm. You have references to both the actual duel and the aftermath of the duel each time through. You have a sort of a louder moment with the duel, and then you have the quiet moment afterwards.
I checked before we started this to make sure that I had it right, but dueling didn't get outlawed until the Civil War, which I always think is interesting, thinking about how frowned upon it is in this moment. And even throughout the show, it's like, you shouldn't go do that, really. It's not illegal, but it's frowned upon. And they won't actually make it illegal until much, much later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I read an article somewhere that talked about how dueling, it was basically a fad, that it, for whatever reason, there was a, you know, this idea of demanding satisfaction from your enemies for misjudging you was something that, it was not something that was always there until it faded away in the Civil War. It was at its height, it's sort of like duel mania was happening in this period, and that's why it's like this, which is kind of funny.
Well, and it's interesting because the mania, as you put it, started in the late 1770s, and then it sort of carried through until around when Hamilton dies. And after a vice president shoots somebody dead, it starts to look a little bit less appetizing.
Nobody likes anything the vice president does.
Nope. I wanted to mention, musically, you mentioned the way that this song carries the way that the duel happened. It starts out in 7/8 time. It's chaotic. It feels difficult to be a part of, listening to it after the insanity that was the actual duel. Everyone's scrambling, go get a medic, the general's coming, this should be fun. It doesn't feel right. And then the second half of the song, with the sirens, with the really consistent orchestrations, it feels so tight and so stressful. And this is only a 90-second song, but you feel so many emotions.
It really takes you through the ringer, and particularly being squished on either end by the 10 dual commandments, and then following that, the heavy, heavy drama of that would be enough, and this tiny little bit in the middle, like, you go between the duel and that would be enough, you're going through like every emotion in the book.
Yeah, this is, I mean, not only does this glue those two numbers together, but you also get, you know, you are setting these relationships down the path a little bit more too, because, you know, we sort of, everybody came together here in this moment, and now they're pushing back apart. I wanted to mention something that, see, this isn't always, you know, mostly on this podcast, we do kind of squee about everything that we're talking about and then analyze it, of course. I wanted to say, there are parts of this song that I do not particularly like, and I say that mostly because I'm not a super knowledgeable musical theater person, but as a less knowledgeable musical theater person, I do feel like there are moments where the compulsion to move the story along and to have everything sort of rhyme and move between and be in meter and move between different characters in the cast leads to some shortcuts that make my eyebrow raise, and not to raise the specter of Stop the Planet of the Apes, I Want to Get Off from The Simpsons, but there are a couple moments in here that are like that, where it's like, meet him inside, where it's like, on one level I'm like, go, we won, here comes the general, this should be fun, where it's like,
help, the human's about to escape,
get your paws off me, you dirty ape.
Lots of bits of story are just being narrated in a way that, I don't know, there are a couple moments where I think, I don't know if I like the way that this is handled, or if I think that this is sort of like my conception of what of what a musical, my bad conception of what a musical is, right? Because usually, and I don't feel that way for almost any other part of Hamilton, but in this song, there are a couple of those moments. I don't know if this is making any sense or not, where it's just like a little on the nose. Things are happening mm-hmm. really fast in like one line of dialogue, like this guy's here. I'm like, okay, right? I don't know. It rubs me the wrong way a little bit.
I agree, or I see how you feel, but I disagree with you. I feel like the reference to "Here Comes the General" is indicative of the way Hamilton uses motifs to be super economical. Again, a 90-second song, a lot happens. Yep. Instead of saying "Washington's here," they use the motif from "Right Hand Man." Here
it's
comes
clear.
The general. Yeah,
sure. Yeah, it's just stacked. It's short and it's stacked so fast that again, I'm willing to forgive it because it's surrounded by brilliance and the story it's telling is very important. But it does feel like shorthand in a moment that, you know, a lot of times Hamilton doesn't do the shorthand, right? It does the big stuff. But this is like, well, I got to move things along here. I don't know.
I see what you mean. And to a certain extent, Here Comes the General is the piece of this that actually rubs me the wrong way, because it's so, I mean, it's, I think it's supposed to be bratty, but I find it kind of snarky and a little, that's the part that I find on the nose. And then Washington whips into center stage and the chorus just kind of like swings around a pillar while they're saying, "Here comes the general." And it's just kind of like visually a little, jazz handsy. Mm. To me, which is probably going to get me attacked.
Oh. Well, the we won right before it also gets me of like, that's so simplistic, and maybe that's the idea there, but it's hard for me to read that as, oh, Hamilton, it's much more complicated than that, and instead think, you know, that's pretty easy to move on to the next thing. It's just like, you know, telling us what happened that we just saw. I don't know.
Well, the we won is really interesting because then that gets called back in Yorktown. And where you move from two guys fighting to a much bigger battle. And then not that long after that, you have the end of the first act and the idea that you're moving on to what is so much harder. You know, you've won. Okay, now how do you run a country?
Yeah, what comes next, so to speak?
So in some ways, you have this increasing level of complexity where you have the same situation repeating again and again. And in some ways, the fatal flaw of Hamilton and of Burr repeating again and again, but with increased seriousness and levels of complexity throughout the show.
There are so many layers to it. I mean, it's funny. And I'm picking up like a little something in something that I actually think is a very interesting piece. And I that's why I wanted to talk about it. But there are just a couple of moments where I'm like, oh yeah, that doesn't hit me dead on like so much of Hamilton does. But boy, when he meets him inside and Hamilton, you know, betrays the guy who has been, you know, in some ways raising him up and protecting him and defending him and will continue to do so, and is such an important partner for him. And he's, you know, he's biting the hand that feeds him because because he's embarrassed about what happened, I think, maybe, or being caught for what happened, and because he wants to establish himself. It's tough. I mean, this is you root for Hamilton and you root for Washington, and here, you know, you don't want to see your friends at odds like this, but that's what happens. So it's tough stuff, and it really stands out for me as a very memorable part of the show.
Going on what you said there, I mean, part of what makes you feel for Hamilton is that you recognize his imperfection, and it's like you can see the truck coming and you're like, get away, move, stop. And you know he's not going to. We all know how it ends, but you can see how impatient he is and how he just wants this so badly, and you just know if he would just calm down, if he would just relax, if he would just listen to Washington. And so I think
you just engage.
Yeah, exactly. Just take a break. I think you engage with that slightly more flawed character, perhaps more easily than you could with George Washington, if Washington was the center of the musical.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if Washington were the center of the musical, I think it would be a much more traditionally patriotic production. Whereas with Hamilton, you get the chaotic revolution that I think is more interesting.
I wanted to say something else about the Washington-Hamilton relationship, too, while we're talking about it, which is Washington says, my name's been through a lot, I can take it. And, you know, Hamilton turns that around. But he got into this situation because he's defending Washington's name, right? This is about Hamilton starting a duel because he feels like Washington is slighted. So when you think of it that way, you know, Hamilton can't have it both ways here, right? If I'm Washington, it's like, well, wait a second. This isn't about you aren't defending yourself. You're defending me. I'm telling you not to. And Hamilton shoots back, well, I don't have your name. But it's like, this isn't about your name, Hamilton. It's about my name.
But I can see where Hamilton thinks it's about him, because Hamilton is his aide-de-camp. It's his secretary. So he's the one who sort of is doing all of the paperwork and all of the talking to people for Washington when Washington's not available. So for him, I suspect, based on the character of Hamilton, he feels like he has a certain amount of reputation to uphold. Whether or not
he's on that side,
he then turns it around and is bratty about it, is, you know.
Well, and the identification of Washington, the person of Washington, the physical body of Washington, and then the second body of him as the symbol of the revolution are completely intertwined. So if you're slighting Washington, in a sense, you're slighting the entire revolutionary ideal that Hamilton is all in on. Like he is not holding anything back at all. And so it's basically saying I'm cutting, when you cut Washington, you're cutting Hamilton's whole reason for being at this point.
Which goes back to Hamilton being really sensitive about perception and perception of him. And this is why he is headed for his fate.
But at the same time, Burr is also very sensitive to that. I think that we have to read these characters as being all of them. That sense of honor, that sense of slight, of that reputation being very, very real to them, and not being something that doesn't have real and concrete political, powerful, day-to-day life repercussions.
Anything else we should talk about this 90-second not sung song before we wrap it up?
The last thing I want to say is the 3 or 4 times in the entire show they go into electronics, because that's one thing I think about a lot when I think of rap, and a lot of the rap I listen to is very electronic. It's used very effectively. It's used in Right Hand Man a few times. It's used in here especially very effectively, and later on in the Reynolds pamphlet where they distort a lot of the vocals. But I feel like here they really do use it perfectly at the very end with the dump, 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 and it ends up being very, very powerful. Hip-hop, it's great.
Well, that wraps up Pod for Ham's little tour through the latest and greatest 90 seconds of Hamilton. Meet me inside. I've been Jason Snell. I want to thank my panelists here. Brian Hamilton, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a party up in here.
Elsa S. Henry, thank you.
Thanks so much.
And Kathleen Showalter, thank you.
Thank you.
Up next week for Pod for Ham is That Would Be Enough. This should be fun. We'll see you next week.
After the war, or you could die, and we need you alive.
I'm more than willing to die.
Your wife needs you alive. Son, I need you alive.
Call me son one more time.
Go home, Alexander. That's an order from your commander.
Sir?
Go home.